The 920 KVEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kvec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 01111911.
This is the Dave Congleton Show, always your hometown radio talk show as we kick off the 5 o'clock hour. Still to come, Tom Likas and former CNN journalist Paul Verkammen pay tribute to Vin Scully, talk about a brand new book. This hour, we continue our focus on the campus protests that are unfolding across the country. Let me remind you from the Washington Post, college students across the country have joined protests since the October 7th Hamas attack and the start of the Israel-Gaza war, with demonstrations swelling again in recent days. That has left university leaders struggling to balance demonstrators' right to speak up with the need to keep campuses safe and welcoming. The latest protest began after police arrested pro-Palestinian demonstrators at Columbia University on April 18th, leading students at several other colleges to put up their own tent encampments in solidarity. More arrests and crackdowns have followed. Any number of ways to look at this topic. Today, we look at it from the perspective of the First Amendment and the right of these students to protest. We've got just the guest for this conversation. As we welcome back to this broadcast, Robert Korn Revere. Bob is one of the leading First Amendment attorneys in the country, has been for decades. He is currently the chief counsel on the staff at FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He is also the author of the book, The Mind of the Censor, The Eye of the Beholder. Why am I babbling? Let's welcome Bob back to the show. Bob, good afternoon.
Hi, Dave. It's great to be back.
Appreciate it very much. And just on a side note, as we dive in, this switch over to FIRE was recent. How's that working out for you, and how do you explain the mission of FIRE to people?
It's been terrific. First, as sort of a background predicate for that, I've been practicing law for over 40 years. The majority of that time has been in private law firms. I've been in private practice. I did spend a short time, 4 years, working with government, but then went back to the private practice of law. FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, as you note, is a longtime client of mine. We had done a number of campus free speech cases together, starting about 12 or 13 years ago. And then about a year and a half ago, FIRE broadened its mission. It was founded in 1999 to deal with campus free speech issues devoted exclusively to the First Amendment and due process in higher education. And then about a year and a half ago, changed its name from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education to the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And because they were dealing with a broader range of First Amendment issues, they reached out to me to see if I would like to join them full time and become a part of that expansion and that mission to deal with First Amendment issues on a broader scale. And so I've been there for almost exactly a year. It has been terrific, and I look forward to going to work each morning.
I bet FIRE has been busy lately, though.
Well, that's the thing. FIRE has been busy since its creation in 1999. At the time it was founded, people thought, okay, we'll do this for 10 years and then we'll solve the problem. But the difficulty with First Amendment issues is there's always another one right over the horizon. And sometimes, as in current days, a whole pile of them right over the horizon and then nearing where you live. So we have been busy.
I'd like to take things a little bit out of order, Bob, because you sent me some background material here, and I was particularly struck by one particular Supreme Court case, Shelton versus Tucker. Can you remind our folks a little bit about that and the importance of that court decision to First Amendment issues on campus?
Well, this was a decision in 1960 by the Supreme Court, and, you know, I should mention again as background that there were a whole number of decisions that went from the 1950s through the 1970s that dealt with issues of the McCarthy era and crackdowns. And then there were campus protests, the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, and increasingly cases that addressed student rights. Sheldon versus Tucker dealt with a condition on people who wanted to be teachers or professors, requiring that they list all of the organizations they are affiliated with. And the Supreme Court said that there are certain things that schools can do to ensure that they're hiring good people, but they can't inquire into what their beliefs are or what their associations are, because that then creates too much conformity.
And it has stood the test of time, because my understanding of it, Bob, is that because I get callers all the time, well, you have free speech, but it's not absolute, and these are kids, blah, 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 blah. But here we have the Supreme Court recognizing the right and the importance of free speech on campuses. It's ingrained in our system.
It is, yeah, and it's ingrained in, I think, the American character. The Supreme Court has set the floor for what the law of free speech is, but there's a bolder and broader principle, and that is a culture of free expression. And that comes down to the willingness of all of us to tolerate ideas that we hate, that upset us, and yet at the same time, there is space in our system for the expression of everybody's ideas, because the alternative is that we fight it out if we aren't talking it out.
Yes, but let me jump ahead. Even with hate speech, is hate speech protected?
Well, yes, it is. And let me explain that hate speech is not a legal concept in the same way that pornography is not a legal concept. Obscenity is, and the adult entertainment material, sexual entertainment, is generally called pornography, but it doesn't fall off the edge of the First Amendment earth unless it meets a rather stringent test for what obscenity is. And hate speech is the same way. Hate speech can be anything that you think, from your perspective, is hateful. And you'll hear a different opinion, depending on who you talk to, about what constitutes hate speech. But the First Amendment presumptively protects speech unless it falls into one of just a handful of carefully defined and limited categories. And so if you make a true threat to somebody, that is not protected. And the Supreme Court, just in the last term, has taken pains to try and define what that means and what the legal requirements are for constituting a true threat. The same is true for incitement. Incitement of others to crime or violence is not protected. But in a decision in the 1960s, the Supreme Court set a really high bar for what constitutes incitement, because you don't want to penalize just people who are speaking in the heat of the moment. They're not intending to create violence. They're very angry, but it doesn't cross that line. And so those tests that set high hurdles for restricting speech have really stood the test of time.
Bob Korn-Revere back on this broadcast. In a recent article in the recent Reason magazine, you called the events since October 7th a turning point for free speech. In what way, Bob?
Well, the editors at Reason called it a turning point for free speech, or at least there's a turning point for free speech with a question mark. What it really is a challenge to our free speech principles, because these principles are not easily maintained. They're really difficult to maintain when you have campuses going crazy, as they are now, with angry demonstrators on all sides of the issue. And the difficult balancing act that really has to be followed is finding a way to allow people to say what they have to say, even if it's unpleasant or hurtful, but at the same time not allowing people to do the same things, commit violence or silence other speakers under the guise of engaging in free speech. Sometimes that includes separating demonstrators on one side or the other to keep them apart so that they don't clash. Sometimes that involves applying neutral time, place, or manner restrictions. But that is the challenge. And I don't envy college administrators these days trying to deal with these issues. It's not easy, but there are time-tested principles that the courts have recognized that show the way.
All right. We are in conversation with Bud Korn Rivera talking about the First Amendment in lieu of everything taking place on college campuses since October 7th. We have more to come, including your phone calls. We're live, we're local. This is Hometown Radio. All right, we got a really great guest here. Bob Korn Rivera is back on this broadcast. He's currently the chief counsel on the staff at FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. He's been in the trenches on behalf of the First Amendment for decades. He's talking about everything happening on college campuses now. We'll take your phone calls after news at the bottom of the hour. Bob, back with you. We've got to talk a little bit about the political response. I thought in the first segment you laid out the fundamentals of the students' rights and why this is important. But now let's start with Florida. What is it that Governor DeSantis tried to do in response to October 7th?
Well, Governor DeSantis tried to deactivate all chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine, claiming that their existence was a violation of law because they were aiding terrorist organizations. This is the kind of broad brush, guilt by association action that the First Amendment does not permit. And yet that was the political response. If you ask me to use one word to describe what much of the political response to all of this has been, I would choose the word opportunistic.
Yeah. Well, you saw that with Speaker Johnson. Where did he go to? Columbia was the campus he went to?
Yeah.
Speaker of the House just shows up on the campus at Columbia. And then what about the governor of New York, Hochul?
Hochul. The Democratic governor of New York. Again, this isn't one party versus another. It crosses those boundaries. But basically, because of the outcry about the rise in anti-Semitism. And by the way, let me be clear. There has been a rise in anti-Semitism and hateful speech, and some politicians are responding to that by going too far. Governor Hochul did so by saying she was going to crack down on universities that didn't enforce against that. Now, again, that obliterates the distinction and the line between hateful but protected speech and speech that is either harassment, incitement, or a true threat.
Well, and then you've got the governor of Texas, Abbott, who recently reaffirmed the importance of free speech on campus.
Well, supposedly, yeah. Sometimes you will have politicians talking about the values of free speech, and then they turn around and do just the opposite. And that was what happened with Governor Abbott, where he signed an executive order that called out specific organizations and basically said he was going to crack down and then preemptively stopped demonstrations, sending in police in body armor and full force. So you have a lot of overreaction going on, and I think, as I said before, a lot of political opportunism.
Well, and we also saw that in the congressional hearings, I believe it was in December, the infamous hearing when there were three women to see. It was Harvard, Penn, and one other.
And MIT.
MIT. They were called before Congress. What happened, Bob?
This was a hearing on dealing with anti-Semitism on campus. They were asking the university presidents to respond to how they address these things. And then Representative Stefanik from New York asked each of them to explain whether or not they would allow calls for genocide on their campus and demand that it be a yes or no answer. And embedded in her question, based on what had gone on in the hearing before then, she was raising the assumption that slogans like From the River to the Sea or By Any Means Necessary necessarily meant calls for genocide. Well, because she asked for just a yes or no answer, it was a trick question. It didn't ask for a sort of nuanced response that you would get. And these three university presidents each sort of stumbled through robotically legalistic answers that were, if you parse them, technically correct, but were drained of all empathy. And they sounded false coming from university presidents that do not have a history of protecting free speech on campus. A better answer was offered by Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of Berkeley Law School and who is a foremost First Amendment scholar. And not only that, just a terrific human being. But he was troubled by the same events. But he, unlike those university presidents, I think had the right answer. And he wrote this in the Los Angeles Daily Journal. And forgive me for quoting this at length, but I think it really drives home the point. He sure. said, I would have said that advocacy of genocide of Jews is repugnant, blatantly inconsistent with the values of my school, and must be immediately condemned by campus officials. I would have expressed that as a Jew who had family members perish in the Holocaust, I'm especially sensitive to such advocacy. But I would also have said that the First Amendment protects hate speech and allows all ideas and views to be expressed, including deeply offensive ones. Even advocacy of genocide is within the speech protected by the First Amendment. There, however, also is a point at which the advocacy is so pervasive that it becomes harassment or that it may be expressed in such a way that it is a true threat that is unprotected by the First Amendment.
Wow.
That statement, had it been made at the hearing in December, I think would have produced a very different atmosphere in how the politicians react to these things.
We're about the 90-second mark with Bob Kornrevere. On the Stolberg line, it's not the speech that is the issue. It is the lawlessness, rule-breaking, and the rights of schools to enforce their rules. How do you respond to that, Bob?
Well, I would say that that is correct, but it's not one thing or the other. You have a lot of protected speech happening, and you have a lot of incidents that are not protected. So when, say, for example, students shout down others to silence them, that is not protected speech. That is the heckler's veto, and the First Amendment protects against that. Or if you chain yourself in a building or block access, you are breaking rules, and you can be subject to reasonable enforcement. So long as force is the last resort, and so long as these are neutrally applied rules and not just favoring one side or the other. As I say, it is not an easy thing to do. But the principles of neutrality and of enforcing so that you protect legitimate speech are principles that you can use as a guide.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the congressional testimony. And then I'm sure you're familiar with the situation down at USC. I can't help but wonder if the cancellation originally of the valedictorian speech was the president of USC was getting worried that they didn't want a repeat of what happened before Congress.
Yes, I understand that. I understand why universities would be rightly concerned about what would happen at these events. I don't have all the facts to evaluate the ultimate decision, but it struck me, just reading about it, as more of an overreaction rather than as an attempt to adjust and prepare for what went on.
All right.
And there's a sort of an object lesson for that.
Let me hold you there, Bob. Let me hold you for the lesson when we come back for the news. Bob Kornrevere is here. Talk about the First Amendment and campus protests. We've got news, traffic, weather, your phone call still to come. This is Hometown Radio. All right, Craig, thank you. If you're just joining us, we are in conversation with Robert Kornrevere, truly one of the leading First Amendment attorney for decades in this country. He's currently chief counsel at FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. We're talking about what has been happening on college campuses since October. And Bob, as we were just heading to the news break, you're about to make a point. I want to circle back and give you a chance to finish, please.
Well, it's a point that's related to things that we've already talked about, because you started by asking about Supreme Court decisions back from the 60s and 70s. And those decisions and the events that led to them have a lot to do and have a lot to say about what's going on now. You and I were in college at the same time. We were debate partners in college. And so you remember those times. Yep. As, you know, times with the anti-Vietnam War protests and all of that. And at Columbia in 1968, which is a little bit before our college days, you had much of the same kinds of things going on then. You had occupation of buildings. You had demands that the university remove any kind of investments or do any kind of contract with the Pentagon. You had the same kinds of demands being made as you see echoed in the protests today, seeking divestment of investments in Israel. So the events of those times are what gave rise to and gave shape to the legal standards that the Supreme Court and lower courts have adopted and applied, and they continue to provide some guidance along those lines. Now, let me also respond again to the question that we got about obeying rules, or the real problem is people breaking rules, and that is true. Free speech doesn't include the right simply to ignore property rights or to shout down other people or things like that. There is a difference between freedom of speech and civil disobedience. Civil disobedience happens when someone is trying to make a point and they knowingly violate the law or knowingly violate the rules. Now, they can make their point, but they're not immune from having the law enforced against them. So if you have people who are deciding to lock themselves in a building or you know, other measure like that, that's civil disobedience and not just free speech.
Yeah, we had a case here a couple of years ago where protesting the George Floyd murder, people, mostly students, went out on our highway here and shut it down for 45 minutes.
I mean, that's right. And if they were arrested, that's not a First Amendment violation.
Well, now here we go on the Stolberg line. Hamas terrorists could care less about our First Amendment. U.S. protesters are lost in their ignorance. I guess my point there, Bob, would be free speech is not based on the intelligence of what you say. You have the right to say something stupid, don't you?
Well, that's right. I didn't hear anything in that statement, which I guess was not a question, that I would disagree with.
805-543-8830 or 800-549-5832. We welcome your phone calls and your text messages for Bob Kornrever as we talk about the First Amendment and what's happening on college campuses. Yet, Bob, despite everything you have said, as you pointed out in your article, there are those who are wondering whether or not there's time to rethink the First Amendment. Who is this woman, Finkelstein, and why is she trying to make this argument?
Well, she is a professor at university at Penn, at University of Pennsylvania, and she is on their free speech committee. She makes the point that the three schools that were involved in that hearing are not governed by the First Amendment, and that is because they are private schools, Harvard, Penn, and MIT. So they are not the government, which is what the First Amendment prevents, but those kinds of private schools and universities in general generally promise the student body they are going to follow First Amendment rules. Professor Finkelstein took the position in a piece in the Washington Post that maybe we really shouldn't have full First Amendment protections on campus. Maybe we should rethink the role of open expression and that academic freedom play in the educational mission of their institutions. And I find it profoundly inconsistent with her role as being on the school's committee on academic freedom.
Yeah. How do you explain that?
I don't. No, well, let me take that back just a bit to say that there is always an ongoing debate about what the limits of free speech should be. It's not unlimited, right? As I've indicated in talking about various exceptions. and you will have a lot of different people, you know, some very well-informed and talented people who argue for drawing the line somewhere other than where I might draw it or someone else might. And it's important to have those debates and important to have those discussions. And ultimately, you know, we'll see how things turn out. What I will say is that the arguments in favor of free expression as opposed to the alternative have been winning the day in the Supreme Court. And that is, it has been quite protective of First Amendment freedoms, even when speech is difficult or sometimes hurtful.
I think that's a very important point, the idea that free speech isn't just what we want to hear. Sometimes it's what we have to hear. Sometimes it's revolting and disgusting, but people still have the right to say it.
Well, that's right. And let me just go one step further and to say that the culture of free expression, which I was talking about earlier, which is broader than just the law of free expression, means that we should, just as a matter of discipline, seek out views that we disagree with. It's not good for anyone to constantly be hearing only things that they agree with. We're all too siloed when it comes to that. It's one of the things that contributes to the polarization that is a cancer in our society. What we need is more open exchange of ideas, and personally, individuals do this to be just be more willing to listen to views you disagree with, and develop a sense of curiosity as to, you know, why the other person takes that view, and not be so certain that you are right.
You and I both admire the comedian Bill Maher, and I was telling you off air that I had seen him earlier this month in San Jose. And one of his arguments, Bob, was that he said, I'm tired of having to hate 50% of the country just because we disagree. And yeah. His argument was that we've got to learn to communicate with people who share different viewpoints than we do if we're to have a future as a country. And I totally agree with that.
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, I also agree with the sentiment that it's just exhausting. It's exhausting to once you decide which team someone is on, you're going to create this entire exile zone where nothing that they say can be right because obviously they embrace bad ideas. There are a lot of people I like who embrace bad ideas, and they're not all this one-dimensional being that exists only for their political outlook. I'll say this too, that too much of what people do is choose based on their political affiliation, right? Politics is only one part of what we all do with our lives, and for it to sort of intrude on every other aspect of our life is, again, not very healthy.
Let's take a call. We've got Jim on KVEC. Hi, Jim.
How are you, David?
Hi, Jim. Good.
Is the do you consider the language that's being used in the universities against the Jewish population to be words of threat and fighting words?
Which words come to mind, Jim?
Well, I'm just saying, just the threats of, you know, elimination, things of that nature. Is that considered to be words of violence, a threat to encourage you to fight?
Bob?
I would say in a general sense, no. In a specific sense, it can be. I've read plenty of examples, and we've been following what's been going on campuses very closely. And there are examples, clear examples, of where people have crossed the line. And it's not just against the Jewish population, but also against supporters of Palestine.
Right, whomever, racial or religious.
Jim, hang on. Let Bob explain. I'll come back to you. Go ahead, Bob.
That's right. But to say something that is hurtful, like from the river to the sea, with what that implies, is still protected speech. It's exactly what Professor Chemerinsky was talking about when he said there is a line between the distasteful and hurtful and those things that constitute true threats. Now, you've mentioned the concept of fighting words. That is a concept that was defined by the Supreme Court in 1942 in a case called Schaplinsky versus New Hampshire. It is a doctrine that, for the most part, doesn't really exist anymore. It was one of the previously recognized exceptions to the First Amendment. It's been replaced by concepts involving incitement or true threats. And those, as I mentioned before, are narrow and carefully defined. And it isn't whatever speech upsets you or that you find rude or distasteful. It's got to be an actual threat of violence.
Jim?
Right, I was reading that also. Fighting words are not protected by the First Amendment. But it seems that there are limitations to threats and fraudulent speech, and obscenities are not protected. The federal courts have found that increasingly severe verbal abuse to be protected speech. The First Amendment generally protects the right to free speech, but that right is subject to limitations.
Yeah, it's not absolute. That is
correct, and that's actually the answer that the presidents of Penn, Harvard, and MIT gave, if badly, when they were at the hearing in December. They said that whether or not it's protected depends on context, and it does. There are a range of factors that you have to look at, and it doesn't just include whether or not this is hateful or distasteful speech.
Yeah. But depends where your commas and your periods are, I guess, huh? Well, I'm just saying. I mean, if you make a constant threat of elimination, wouldn't that encourage someone to consider that to be a situation where they require self-defense? In other words,
This is where these legal tests came from, because the original doctrine under sort of the clear and present danger rule would allow the government to punish speech or to criminalize speech if it simply had what was called a, quote, bad tendency to lead to unlawful acts or to, advocating the overthrow of the government or so on. That bad tendency test allowed all kinds of prosecutions for just basic dissent. And during World War I, over 2,000 people were prosecuted under the the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. That test, first articulated by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, was replaced over the years as the Supreme Court and lower courts refined First Amendment doctrine and made it more specific. And it developed tests for things like incitement, where you have to intend immediate lawless action and be speaking in a context that is likely to promote immediate lawless action. It's a much higher test, and it's what is required to protect the ability to engage in vigorous serious speech, unless you're going to simply allow the government to enforce against anything that people dislike.
We'll leave it at that. Jim, thanks for the call. Bob Korn Revere on this broadcast on the Stolberg text line. Mike weighs in. Les Osos. Hey, Mike, your guest has given a fantastic defense of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. America needs a refresher course. I'm sure Bob appreciates the praise. We'll come back for a final segment right here on KVEC. All right, we are in conversation with Robert Korn Revere, leading First Amendment attorney, now chief counsel at FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, talking about what's been happening on college campuses and the importance of maintaining the right of expression, your First Amendment right of expression. Now, if you want in on this conversation, you need to call or text in and express yourself, 805-543-8830. Or 800-549-5832. Bob, back with you. I'm not sure I understand this next text, but a listener is arguing on the Stolberg line that we need to create a political system that has multiple parties, and that will solve any more problems. I'm not sure it's that simple. Are you?
I've don't think it's that simple if you take Europe as a model. I mean, there you have multiple parties, and it hasn't really made those societies less polarized or less angry than people are in our own. I tend to agree with the idea that if you have just two people or two groups representing different sides that are just shouting at each other across the void, having a broader conversation is a good thing. But I don't know if more political parties is necessarily the answer for that.
My concern is that there is talk, as you know, among some electeds, they want the National Guard to be sent on college campuses. And I'm thinking, you know, May 4th, 1970, how many students were killed at Kent State by Ohio National Guardsmen? Haven't we gone down this path before, Bob?
We have gone down this path before, and that's why I think there are lessons that we learned from the experience on campuses in the 60s and early 70s, which are really analogous to what we have now. And both the legal protections have evolved from the lessons learned then, but also trying to understand, or at least learning from history, what not to do. And putting troops on campus is a recipe for disaster.
Well, it just simply is on so many different levels. So given all this, let's look on our crystal ball and muse about where this is going. I mean, a lot of the semesters are ending. Students might be going home. But where do you see this going, Bob?
Well, I think given the fact that world events are driving the protests, I have to watch what's going on with world events and see if the protests either intensify or abate. We also have an upcoming Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
In Chicago.
And if you remember 1968, you know, that also indicates that we're likely to see much of the same there. Again, it is a time for people to keep their heads about them rather than to go off the rails and look for opportunities to score political points.
And what's the role of FIRE, your organization, in this? What are they going to be doing?
Well, we're going to be defending free speech when students and faculty rights are violated. We have done that on all sides of the conflict in the political spectrum. We advocate not just for the law of free expression, but we also want to reach hearts and minds and talk about the basic values of a culture of free expression and why it's important for people to internalize those values and live them. It's much more than just what the law says.
Well, and, you know, as you noted in the Reason article, the protest started, I think, at Harvard, and it was Ivy League schools, and then it was some West Coast schools. But now it's at the University of Georgia, and it's at Texas Tech, and we have a small Cal Poly up north, Cal Poly Humboldt. I mean, it's not just these supposed liberal bastion universities. This thing is spreading everywhere.
And it's very much like the protests during the Vietnam War. That started on the larger elite campuses and then spread across the country.
Right. But you mentioned that. Is that a fair parallel to compare what you and I went through in the late 60s, early 70s, protesting Vietnam with what these young people are doing today? I mean, it's kind of the same thing. It's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
Well, it's very much the same thing in certain ways, but of course the issues are not the same issues. You don't have people who are demonstrating today facing the prospect of being drafted into a war they disagree with. You have different specific issues and some different specific triggers, but the idea of how you manage this environment is very much the same.
Yeah, and it's the right to express yourself and have your voice heard.
It's the right to express yourself, but there also is the element of allowing people to do that in a way that preserves order. And this is the lesson that I was referring to earlier that I didn't get to, and that is, if you remember back to 2017 and the Unite the Right rally that took place in Charlottesville, Virginia,
yes,
one that turned deadly when one of the protesters on the right drove his car into another group and killed a young woman, injured others, and the mayhem that occurred during that time. And it was widely understood in the aftermath of that that the Charlottesville police simply didn't provide a sufficient presence. They didn't separate the demonstrators. They didn't take a number of actions that could have done more to preserve order. A week after that, for a much larger crowd, the Boston police were able to manage the Unite the Right situation there with no injuries. So there are lessons to be learned from how you manage these things. You do not permit people to commit violence in the name of free speech. You do not permit them to silence others or to violate the law in other ways. But the official response is obligated under our Constitution to, within those parameters, make it available for people to express themselves.
Bob Corn-Revere, we so appreciate your time and your perspective. Thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much, sir.
Oh, thank you, Dave. Always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, sir. Off we go. News, traffic, weather. We got Tom Likas. We've got Paul Verkammen. We've got the women who are small business owners. We've got another hour of Hometown Radio still to go. Stick around.
The 920 KBEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kbec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 0111-911.